Okay, now into the subject matter of the course. And our first major subject is the nature and value of the subject. What is economics all about, and why is it worth studying? And I give you right off the bat a definition of economics, not by any means the only possible definition, but the one I think is most helpful. Economics is the science that studies the production of wealth under a system of division of labor. Under a system of division of labor. Now, what is the division of labor? Well, it's the separation of the total labor required to support a human life into separate, distinct occupations. If we had gone around and I had asked each of you what kind of work you do, probably there would be no two identical answers. Each person, even if you're working at the same company as some others, almost certainly you have a different job description. We have an enormous number of specializations and subspecializations, and in a division of labor economy, in any first world economy, all of which are division of labor economies, the way people live is by devoting their practically their entire working time to the production of just one thing or a very small number of things, or they're merely performing one simple step in helping to produce just one or at most a small number of things. That's what they devote their full time to, and virtually everything that they produce, all or almost all of it, is consumed by people other than themselves. At the same time, practically everything that each of us consumes is produced by the labor of others. So if you think of the particular job that you're doing, maybe you're a sales representative for a pharmaceutical firm. Okay, well then you're helping in the production of some medications. You're making the physicians aware of them and the benefits. And that's what you're devoting your full working time to. But the people who are getting the benefit of these medications is almost entirely or entirely other people. So if you're helping to in the distribution of Celebrex, the odds are you yourself don't use any Celebrex and no one in your family does. But many other people do, and you're devoting your entire working time to the satisfaction of the needs and wants of others. But by the same token, all of the food you eat, the clothes you wear, the automobile you drive, the apartment or house that you live in, all of this is produced by the labor of others. And this represents division of labor. Now, people have not always lived this way. And even right now, the majority of the world's population still does not. Typical mode of economic life for most of history and even today in most of the world is people are devoting their labor to producing the things that they and their families consume. So if you have a farmer in some third world country, his labor is devoted to producing the food that his family will eat. And such people, maybe with the help of a few neighbors, construct their own shelter. They may even make their own clothing. They have a very limited peripheral connection to the market. Relatively little of their labor is producing things that others consume. Relatively little of what they consume is produced by the labor of others. Now, this is rapidly changing. Not many years ago, one could say that perhaps only 15 or 20% of the world's population lived in first world division of labor societies. But that's undergoing major expansion today. Large segments of China are becoming integrated into the global division of labor, important parts of India, and it very well may be that the leading development of this new century will be that by the end of it, practically the entire population of the world will be incorporated into a global division of labor. The origin and development of the division of labor society. in modern times goes back perhaps as far as the 17th century in England. Its early progress was very slow. By the end of the 18th century, Great Britain represented perhaps the sole country in which could be characterized as a division of labor society. In the 19th century, it spread to the countries of Western Europe, the United States, Japan, and overseas British dominions. And then in the latter part of the 20th century, Taiwan became incorporated, Singapore, and then more recently, large parts of Thailand, Malaysia, and now it's getting solidly into China and India. And if they become incorporated, that will probably represent a substantial majority of the world's population. Now, why is the division of labor important? Well, I go into the subject in detail in Chapter 4, and in the syllabus I probably refer to it as the main discussion coming in Week 3, but it's perhaps a good idea to jump into it now. Organizing production into a division of labor is an essential requirement for a high and rising productivity of labor, a high and rising output per unit of labor. And there are a variety of reasons for this. One leading reason is that to the extent that labor is divided into separate distinct occupations and sub-occupations, the amount of knowledge that enters into the production of things is correspondingly multiplied. The greater the degree of division of labor, the larger is the overall total volume of knowledge that enters into the productive process. And we can illustrate this, I think, in terms of a simple example. Imagine that you could get some kind of grant, either from a foundation or the Department of Education, and the purpose of your grant would be to take a census of the knowledge used in production in the interior, the rural interior of China or India. And let's say you were supplied with a good supply of notebooks, tape recorders, maybe you'd need batteries only because you might not even find electricity. And assume you could spend time with a friendly, receptive farm family, and your assignment was to learn and record everything this family knew about any aspect of production. So you'd learn what crops they planted, when they planted, how they tended them, how they harvested them, what they did with them, and everything else in any way related to production. How they made their clothing, how they constructed their shelter, whatever it might be. And presumably you could fill several notebooks or several rolls of several cassettes of tape. But at some point, you would have exhausted the knowledge of this rural family. Now the question would be, if you had the time to go and interview another 10 or 100 million other such families living in the same way, how much more could you learn about what enters into production? Yes?
You might learn a little bit more, but they're probably, all the same, you might specialize in certain areas, or overall it'll be the same.
I would say it would be just about exactly the same. I mean, maybe you could learn a few extra details. Someone that you might interview later might be a more clever, self-sufficient farmer. They might know a few tricks the others didn't. But I would say once you interviewed one, you would know pretty much what all of them knew, with very, very little difference. Now, contrast that with attempting to take a census of the knowledge that enters into production in a first world country. How many people are living and working in the same way in a country with extensive division of labor.
Most people are doing different occupations and other skills.
All kinds of different occupations and sub-occupations. For example, we don't have simply generic farmers. We have wheat farmers, dairy farmers, cattle ranchers, cotton farmers, on and on. All kinds of specializations and subspecializations. And there are many intermediate steps. We have people engaged in refining the seed the farmers will use, and that will likely become more important with genetically engineered seed. And then you have a variety of steps further back. We have other people engaged in producing a wide array of agricultural equipment and performing further steps in producing the things necessary for that equipment. And we don't have generic engineers. We have chemical engineers, mining engineers, civil engineers, electrical engineers, and on and on and on. And each of these specializations and subspecializations has a very extensive body of knowledge. And at lower levels, we don't just have generic workers. There are significant differences between auto workers and steel workers. And among auto workers, there's wide differentiation in the particular kinds of work, and similarly among steel workers. Now, we have as many distinct bodies of knowledge entering into the production of things as we have distinct specializations. Now, what do you think this implies about the overall volume of knowledge that enters into the production of things in a division of labor society compared to a society of self-sufficient farmers?
Now, with each additional person you add to the process, you gain a wider variety of knowledge.
We have an incredibly larger volume of knowledge. You see, in a society of self-sufficient farmers, there's essentially one body of knowledge. That's the body of knowledge they all share. That's what enters into the productive process, a body of knowledge that one farmer or one farmer plus his wife can hold. That essentially defines the volume of knowledge that goes into the production of things in a non-division of labor society. In a division of labor society, the volume of knowledge is the product of, or the sum of the all the specialized bodies of knowledge of all the different occupations and sub-occupations. So it's enormously greater. Now, if you knew nothing else at all, I think this would probably be sufficient to understand the profound differences that exist between the standard of living of a first world country and a third world country. The standard of living of a third world country is essentially the reflection of the limited body of knowledge that can be held by just one person or one family, or at most a collection of villagers. In a first world country, the body of standard of living reflects the enormously greater volume of knowledge that is built upon this system of specialization. All of the specializations have their own contribution.
Is there anything filling the second one?
Pardon me?
Is there anything filling the space that with the fall of the Soviet Union that the second world has
got? Okay. If you take the Soviet Union as representing the second world, actually, it would largely be subsumable under the third world, or much of it. Not all of it. There are some areas, like I mentioned, St. Petersburg and maybe Moscow and a few other cities, they're closer to the modern world. They're more or less integrated. But there are vast stretches of rural areas where they haven't made much headway yet. And they're closer, I would say, to the third world. Yeah. The former Soviet Union was largely a third world country, with some exceptions. All right, well now, there are some other related gains in a division of labor society, closely connected to this multiplication of knowledge. Just think that in order to produce many of the products that we take for granted, their production is only possible on the foundation of a very wide body of knowledge, a very wide range of knowledge. So you just think, if we were to ask, what's required to produce something relatively simple, like this ballpoint pen? Do you think there is any one person who knows the totality of what's required to produce such a thing? I mean, you could name in broad strokes, you could say, well, you need plastic. You need ink. You need a metal point. Okay. But in order to actually get all of this starting from nature, you have to have a knowledge of mining the different chemicals. You have to have a knowledge of producing mining machinery, a knowledge of making plastic. Plastic comes from petrochemicals. You need to be able to extract petroleum. You need to refine it. To do that, you need to make petroleum refining equipment. You need a transportation system. Undoubtedly, you need electric power. You take any relatively simple product, and if you investigate what lies behind it, it's like a point on a spider web of complexity. There are all sorts of things behind it, all sorts of things alongside of it. And this becomes true even of products that could be produced with radically less division of labor. Again, a non-division of labor society, they can grow a certain amount of rice. And the way they grow it is relatively simple. But if you're talking about growing rice in a division of labor society, what sorts of things do you think are involved?
Biochemistry.
It could be biochemistry. You'd have all kinds of agricultural equipment. You might have complicated irrigation systems. Certainly you'd have electric power. You'd have diesel fuel or gasoline and everything behind that. You'd have ocean freighters, modern railroads. So even the kinds of things that can be produced with little division of labor in a division of labor society are produced in a far more complicated way. Not that we want to make things complicated as an end in itself, but because that ends up being vastly more efficient. If we're growing rice, it's much, much more efficient to be able to do it by modern methods of mass agriculture than to do it the way it was done traditionally. But then there are all kinds of products that are not possible at all except on the foundation of a broad array of knowledge. So you just think, would such a thing as a jet engine be possible in a society whose volume of knowledge was limited essentially to what one individual or one family could hold? Not at all. In a division of labor society, we routinely can have products whose existence would otherwise be altogether impossible, because so much knowledge is required directly or indirectly in their production, far more knowledge than any one person, family, or village could possibly hold. So we're able routinely to produce things that require immense amounts of knowledge. And similar to this is the wide variety of materials that's required for most products. In order to produce anything as complex as a jet engine, or not even that much, a television set, a radio, practically anything, you need today a fairly extensive variety of materials. And as I'm sure you all know, materials are not found in a uniform mixture across the face of the earth. Certain things are found in great concentrations in some locations. We have a high concentration of iron ore in the Mesabi Range in Minnesota, another one in Labrador, I think another one perhaps in Venezuela, a few more places. Petroleum is found in concentrations in certain areas, not at all in other areas. And in order to produce the kinds of things that we take for granted, you need access to a pretty wide variety of nature-given raw materials. Well, only a division of labor society makes this possible. in a division of labor, each area concentrates to some important degree on exploiting its particular mineral advantages and its particular climate advantages for growing different crops. So we have the people up in Minnesota in the iron mining region. They produce vastly more iron ore than they themselves require. Other people in coal mining areas produce vastly more coal than they require. And similarly, Juan Valdez and his friends are producing vastly more coffee than they require, and on and on and on. And the result is that each area, by virtue of division of labor and trade, is able to gain the advantages of all of the different raw materials and different growing conditions found across the world. And this, too, is necessary for many, many products of any degree of complexity. We could not produce many, many of the things, perhaps most of the things, we now take for granted without both the geographical aspect of the division of labor and the multiplication of knowledge. So these are enormously important matters. And then finally, serving to continually improve the process is the fact that in a division of labor society, a large proportion of the most intelligent and ambitious members of such a society devote their working time, their concentration, on the acquisition and application of new knowledge. This is what scientists are doing, and inventors, and important parts of business firms, the research and development departments of business firms. And wider than that, a major aspect of the activity of businessmen is to search out and even instigate the development of new products and methods of production, which represents enlargement of the body of knowledge that's used in making things. So now we not only have this vast multiplication of knowledge corresponding to all the different specializations and subspecializations, the advantages of geographical specialization, but at the same time, from generation to generation, the level of knowledge tends to improve, because a significant proportion of the most intelligent and ambitious members of the society are devoting their efforts to acquiring and applying new knowledge. And then the process of economic competition compels everybody to meet the standard of the new and better products. So if you're producing something and now your competitor comes out with some improvement, you'll almost certainly have to adopt something comparable, or you'll be driven out of business. So the advances instituted anywhere, if they in fact are advances, will tend to be generalized, and the degree of knowledge and the level of production tends to rise on this basis from generation to generation.
This is George Reisman in 2020. I want to add that just as the division of labor makes it possible for people to concentrate on the discovery and application of new knowledge, so too it also enables people with special talents in any area, such as the arts, being an opera singer, being an outstanding athlete. It makes it possible for people with all special rare talents to concentrate full-time on exploiting those talents. And the result is that the society as a whole benefits from being able to enjoy the exploits of these people. So if we had had a primitive non-division of labor society, great talents such as Pavarotti, outstanding baseball players and basketball players and so forth, they'd be growing their own turnips instead of doing what they're doing. So it's important to keep that in mind also.
And I would say the division of labor underlies the use of machinery. Machines are fairly complicated products. They require a wide foundation of knowledge of different sorts. They require a wide variety of materials. If we didn't have a division of labor, it's doubtful we could have any kinds of machinery. And you could understand why the Industrial Revolution began in Great Britain in the 18th century. Britain met two essential requirements for the development of machinery. They had the highest degree of division of labor of any country in the world at the time, and they were the world's leading commercial nation. They had available to them whatever materials could be found anywhere in the world at the time. So they were able to assemble the variety of materials and a sufficient variety of bodies of knowledge to make the production of the first machines a possibility. So the division of labor is really a very, very major issue. And as I say, it's the essential requirement for a high and rising productivity of labor, high and rising output per unit of labor. Now, finally, you hear a lot about the word globalization. Globalization can be understood as representing the ultimate extension of the division of labor throughout the world. If and when the entire world is incorporated into the division of labor, then the division of labor will have been carried to its greatest possible extent. Globalization is simply a continuation of what we've had for the last two centuries or so. Instead of people producing for themselves on their own farms, they're producing for others at greater and greater distances to a greater and greater extent, and they're being supplied more and more heavily by others over greater and greater areas. Well, the ultimate culmination of this is the entire world participating in the division of labor. And you could see some major advantages in that. Just on the basis of economies of scale, particularly of an intellectual nature, and I'll jump ahead and give you an example I normally save for a much later lecture. Just consider the number of doctors that we can have is limited by the surrounding population. In order to keep a doctor tolerably fully occupied, he has to have enough people around who will break their arm often enough or need an appendix removed or God knows what in order to keep him fairly busy. If we had a society of five people, it's very doubtful that anyone could specialize as a doctor. You couldn't work full-time that way. Well, imagine that in order to keep someone tolerably fully employed as a physician, you need 1,000 people. So you can have one doctor. I don't know what the actual number is, but let's say every 1,000 people require the presence of one physician. Now, if we want to have a medical school, this requires that we have a substantially larger population. Imagine that an efficient-sized medical school will turn out 100 graduates a year. Again, I don't know the actual number, but it's something, and we're interested in establishing the pattern. All right, suppose the average physician will practice for 40 years after graduation. Well, if an efficient-sized medical school turns out 100 graduates a year, and on average they practice 40 years, that means that ultimately we'd have 4,000 physicians. Well, what kind of size of population would we need to keep these 4,000 physicians tolerably well occupied if each one needs 1,000 people? We'd need 4 million people. Okay, but now suppose out of 4,000 physicians, or out of any 1,000 physicians, suppose that only one is a brain specialist. Well, now if we had only 4 million people in our society with one medical school ultimately generating 4,000 doctors, we'd have only 4 brain specialists. What would be the advantage of a society, not of 4 million people, but of 400 million people, with respect to the number of brain specialists? Well, instead of 4 brain specialists, we can now have 400. But how about a society of 4 billion people? Well, now we could have 4,000 brain specialists. What advantage do you think there would be in 400 brain specialists versus 4, or better still, 4,000 versus 400? What do you think the advantage would be in terms of the likelihood of discovering new remedies for brain diseases? Doesn't it tend to increase the larger the absolute number of highly intelligent, motivated people we have dealing with the problems? And as you get up to, you see, 4 brain specialists, they can have a journal of brain diseases. 400 might, 4,000 might be able to support several such journals. Then they can have a convention in Hawaii also. But now, doesn't this same principle apply to all areas concerned with the acquisition and application of knowledge? Wouldn't it apply to all branches of engineering as well as medicine, all branches of science? So you just think, what happens to the likelihood of the discovery and application of new knowledge the larger the absolute number of people in on the project? Doesn't it increase? I would say that a major explanation of the progress of the last decades, despite many, many negative developments working in the opposite direction, the fact that we've been able to advance in so many areas of knowledge and technology, I think is very, very heavily due to the expansion of the division of labor. Just the fact that we have substantially larger absolute numbers of highly intelligent, motivated people working on these different problems. And the success that comes anywhere can quickly be communicated everywhere. Well, if we have a global division of labor, I don't know what the world population is right now. I think estimates are about 6 billion. Well, if we had all 6 billion people in the world integrated into the division of labor, that would mean that all of the branches concerned with the acquisition and application of new knowledge would be carried on a larger absolute scale with a greater likelihood of success. We'd have an acceleration in the rate of technological and economic progress. So this, I think, is an immensely positive development. But it's not something that occurs inevitably. It's not something that must result. There are factors that can stop the division of labor, that can turn it in the opposite direction. Can anyone think of any sorts of developments that can work against the division of labor? Pardon me?
In what way?
Preventing its further extension and causing it to be reduced.
How much?
Pardon me? Excuse me?
Taxes and regulatory?
Well, at one level that could happen, but can anyone think of anything more dramatic?
Ideological.
Well, if the conflict were just ideological, if there are people who simply disagree with each other, but they're not manning the barricades, I don't think that would do it. Yeah.
War?
War is something that can really wreck the division of labor.
Isolationism?
Well, it would depend on what you meant by isolationism, but let's think of war for a moment. War in the conditions of a modern country has often been compared to the baker fighting the tailor. Now, if the baker and the tailor are in combat with one another, how does the baker get his clothing? How does the tailor get his bread? They can't rely on it. Now, imagine that we were to have a major war in modern conditions, what would happen to us if we currently import, I think, on the order of half of our petroleum? And there's large quantities of all sorts of other things that we import. Everything is extremely intertwined with foreign trade today. What would happen if we could no longer count on importing substantial quantities of things from outside the United States? What would be the effect of that on our standard of living?
It would affect our productivity because we'd no longer be able to utilize those resources.
We couldn't utilize them. Now, there'd be a dramatic decline. Now, it's very possible if the United States and North America itself remained free of warfare, but was just cut off from foreign supplies, possibly there would be a terrible initial shock, and then it might be that we could expand the production of many of the things that we had imported, expand them domestically, and at the same time cut back on the production of many of the things that we had exported. That would be a significant retrogression in the division of labor, but maybe if you're talking about the whole of North America or the whole of the Western Hemisphere, maybe you could, that would still have broad enough area, a big enough area, to maintain a modern standard of living, but not at as high a level as if we had a global economy. But suppose the chaos and the warfare were greater than that. Suppose you wouldn't have a peaceful North America. Suppose we had a conflict within North America. Suppose the different states were warring with one another, or the different counties. Now, can anyone think of a historical situation that in principle resembles such a thing?
Civil War.
Well, the Civil War, that was a major conflict between two parts of the United States, that's true. But there wasn't that much integration of the economy of the South with the North. The food consumed in the North was grown in northern states. The South's international trade, they were exporting large quantities of cotton and other crops to Britain and Europe, and they were importing manufactured goods from Britain. The worst effect economically of the Civil War, other than the destruction going on in the South, was the cotton textile industry in Britain was wrecked for a number of years. But I think there are more dramatic examples. We have a period of centuries of self-sufficient production and a miserably low standard of living accompanying it, following a period of centuries of relatively great division of labor. Does anyone know?
The Dark Ages.
Pardon me?
The Dark Ages.
The Dark Ages followed what?
The barbarian invasions.
Which?
The Mongol hordes.
Well, the Mongol hordes were part of it later on.
All of Rome.
Yeah, there was the Roman Empire. The early Roman Empire represented the greatest degree of division of labor in all of history until perhaps as late as the 16th century. They achieved, back in the 2nd century A.D., a very considerable division of labor that ranged from Britain in the northwest all the way down to the Arabian Peninsula in the southeast. The Roman Empire ringed the whole Mediterranean, all of Western Europe, portions of Germany, Yugoslavia, all of North Africa, Egypt, Palestine, Turkey. And there was extensive trade. Tin mined in Britain showed up in Syria. Vases produced in Syria could be found in France, and they also had extensive trade beyond the borders of the empire. Well, this was followed by centuries of feudalism, whose leading economic characteristic was the self-sufficiency of very narrow territories. Each little feudal domain attempted to produce within its own territory virtually everything consumed in that territory. So you'd have each little territory, maybe with a 10 or 15 mile radius, they would attempt to produce everything that they required for consumption there. Now, what brought that about? Well, prolonged warfare. See, if you have war going on continually, can you count on outside supplies? So if you can't count on any outside supplies, what do you have to do to get supplies? You have to produce them yourself. Well, it started with civil war within the Roman Empire. They had a century of civil war, the third century. That was also a century of inflation. They started with gold and silver coins. The Roman government kept expanding the quantity of money by collecting gold and silver coins and taxes, melting them down, adulterating them with lead and copper. They kept expanding the quantity of money to meet an insatiable desire for the government to spend. Prices rose astronomically. They imposed wage and price controls. That deprived many key industries of profitability. That by itself undercut the division of labor. Ultimately, they repudiated their own currency. They refused to accept their own coinage in payment of taxes. And that's when payment of taxes in sheep and goats got started. They could no longer pay the Roman legions in money. And so they relied on farmer militia, who were no match for the barbarians. Then you had the barbarian invasions. And then you had local warfare among the feudal lords for centuries. And so there was hardly any division of labor for centuries. Yeah, sorry to keep you off.
Well, no, I was just curious. Rome, for its most part, was in a constant state of war. So how did it control, if the argument goes, obviously it's a different circumstance, because they were the conquerors and had more of an infrastructure to execute against?
No, you see, they may have been in one war or another, at one place or another, but the first two centuries of the modern era, the first and second centuries A.D., I think are often described with the words Pax Romana, the Roman peace. See, Rome overcame all of the rivals, and there were basically peaceful conditions, not 100%, but in most places for the better part of 200 years. And so that permitted relatively great economic development. And then, when that ended, things fell apart.
As a somewhat related second question, yeah. Was that tradition passed down because the Ottomans took an extremely, from what I understand, an extremely efficient approach to division of labor too, did they not?
I am not aware of that. For some reason, the division of labor survived better, conditions were better in the eastern part of the Roman Empire. The Byzantine portion carried on till I think 1453, but they were constantly plundered and looted too, so I don't think they survived at their previous level. But certainly in the Western Roman Empire, France, Italy, Germany west of the Rhine, Spain, Portugal, Belgium, Britain, they were set back to the state of feudalism for centuries. So warfare will destroy it. Things that lead to warfare, like I mentioned, the third century was a century of inflation and civil war. There was civil war before the Romans were overcome. In our terms today, I think terrorism is a factor that works against the division of labor. Just think what the effects would be if terrorists could take out some significant bridges and tunnels. How disruptive that would be. And there are other things that can happen if we got into a state of chronic shortages. anything that creates a situation in which you cannot count on being supplied by others. That there's something you need and want, must have, but you can't get it in the market. What happens if there's something you just can't find in the market? What do you have to do if you want to obtain it?
What about having to pay the high price?
Well, you see, if you're free to pay the high price, you'll be able to get it. If you can't find it in the market, then you have to produce it yourself. Anything that works in the direction of stopping people from obtaining things in the market, that drives them toward self-sufficiency. Now, we have a few small things of this kind that go on now. To the extent that people become concerned that they won't be able to get electric power from the power companies because there'll be brownouts and blackouts. Well, what do some people attempt to do to cope with that? Have their own generators, put in solar panels, whatever, to have their own source of power. There are hospitals with their own generating systems. There are some business firms with their own generating systems. Now, so far, this hasn't gone very, very far. But suppose we got to the point where you just couldn't count on getting electric power from the power company. Well, that would require that if people want power, they have to produce it themselves. That would be a step going away from division of labor. That would be substantially less efficient. It wouldn't be enough to destroy the system, but it's a step in the wrong direction. People attempt to make substitutions, and sometimes if there's a limited interference, a limited problem, they can find substitutions, and then they proceed and there's not much effect. But suppose all the different avenues are cut off. We can't get petroleum, so we turn to natural gas. And then what if we can't get the natural gas? Well, then you might say, okay, how about atomic power? But suppose that's blocked. It might be that you have limited blockages that you can work around, and then there's merely a temporary setback, or it could be there's no way around, and then you're stuck. Now, anything that creates shortages. A shortage is a situation in which there are people able, willing, and very often eager to pay the announced price. But despite that, they can't find the item in the market. And that's a situation where the thing is just unavailable in the market. And so anytime there is a shortage, if it persists, that's a situation in which people will be driven to produce something themselves. And as we'll see in a few weeks, shortages can easily be brought into being, and what brings them into being is a combination of inflation and price controls. See, inflation tends to drive up the prices of things. That disturbs many, many people. It hurts many, many people. And a popular response to rising prices is to prohibit the rise, impose a price control. But when you do that, the result is a shortage. You see, as we have more and more money and people attempt to spend more, well, that's driving up the price. If you don't allow the price to go up, you're not doing anything to curtail the quantity demanded. You're giving people more and more money. They're attempting to buy more and more. But if there isn't that much more, if they're attempting to buy more than there is, well, in a free market, the price would rise. As the price rose, what happens to the amount people attempt to buy? That goes down. In a free market, a rise in price always operates to keep the quantity that people are attempting to buy commensurate with the quantity available. But if you have a frozen price, the quantity people attempt to buy can easily surpass the quantity available, and then you have a shortage, and that means a situation where people can't find what they want in the market. And if this is something that becomes persistent, then they have to attempt to produce it themselves. So price controls create shortages. shortages, if persistent, work to make people attempt to be self-sufficient. All right, well, all of this connects with the wider subject, the need for economics, its leading applications. As I've indicated with the discussion of Rome and what followed it, the division of labor doesn't exist or function automatically. It doesn't exist or function automatically. And the leading illustrations in history are the fall of the Roman Empire and its replacement with feudalism, a relatively high degree of division of labor, followed by self-sufficiency for centuries, and then later on, the reestablishment of the division of labor with the modern world. You can think of economic history from perhaps the 14th century on, or maybe even a little bit before that. You can think of the broad sweep of economic history subsequent to the Dark Ages as more or less coextensive with a rise in the division of labor. And this started very, very slowly and gradually and greatly intensified in the 18th and then the 19th and then finally the 20th centuries and still going on today. Now, if you know what is it, what are the things that are required to have a successfully functioning and growing division of labor, what are the things that will wreck it, that gives major insight, I think, into understanding the broad sweep of economic history. You can understand the collapse of the Roman Empire by understanding what sorts of things wreck the division of labor and how were they present in the period of the decline of the Roman Empire. And you can see a combination of civil war and war, and the civil wars brought on in large measure by other economic policies, inflation and price controls serving to greatly reduce the productive capacity of the Roman economy, weaken it militarily. And then you can understand the rise of the modern world in terms of developments that are favorable to the division of labor. One leading to such development being the pacification of the countryside in Europe. There came a point where the chronic warfare of the feudal period stopped, where the kings attained military supremacy over the feudal nobility, and the feudal nobility ended up disbanding their private armies. And then you had relative peace within the countryside of the European countries. Goods could move from one part of the country to another freely. People could start depending on outside supplies getting in. They could start producing for the outside to get a revival of the division of labor. Now, the Magna Carta was a limitation on the powers of King John, respecting certain powers of the nobility. But the nobility was no longer engaging in private warfare. You see, what happened, one of the things that Adam Smith points out, he has a lot of historical commentaries in The Wealth of Nations. There was a period in the heyday of feudalism, the main interest of the feudal aristocrats was how can they maintain their knights in the greatest state of military readiness. That's all that they were concerned with. But then somewhere along the way, the aristocrats developed a taste for luxuries. And they didn't want to have to devote all of their revenues to supporting men-at-arms. They wanted to free that up so that they could have a fancier castle, or furnish it better, have better clothing, a nicer carriage, whatever. And then they became interested in measures that would eliminate their need to support men-at-arms, so they could free up their revenue in indulging their taste for luxuries. And this played a role in putting an end to continual private warfare. And that allowed some greater economic development. Now, as we'll see at one point in the term, a vital foundation of a division of labor society is respect for private property rights. And this was a development that took hold more in Great Britain than anywhere else, and in the countries that Britain founded. And a rule of law. These are developments required for the growth of the division of labor, and they occurred above all in Britain. All right, well, if we think of economics as the science which studies the production of wealth under the division of labor, and we recognize the division of labor has definite requirements for its existence and successful functioning, that there are other things that will wreck and even destroy it, then we recognize what depends on the division of labor, the multiplication of knowledge, the whole productivity of labor, products that would otherwise be impossible, machinery, then I think we're in a position to appreciate economics as actually having its finger on the requirements of the standard of living and even of human survival. Just think, what would be the consequences if the division of labor were substantially wiped out in the modern world? Just think, what are the present population of the United States is close to 300 million people. How many of us would be able to live if we were attempting to live as self-sufficient farmers? If you divide if you convert the land area of the United States, the lower 48 states has approximately 3 million square miles. There's 640 acres in a square mile. If you multiply 3 million times 640 and divide by 300 million, I think it works out to something like 9 acres a person. And much of that is desert and mountains, so it's much less per person. How many of us could survive as self-sufficient farmers? Only a small fraction of the number presently alive. And what would be the standard of living of those who did survive? Miserable poverty at the level of the worst areas of the third world. And then if you look at places like Japan, where they have a greater population density over Western Europe, what would happen to the population of the modern world if we lost the division of labor? It would be radically reduced. You know, the population of the world was more or less constant at about 1 billion people up to the 18th century. And now it's gotten to, I think, close to 6 billion. Well, what do you think has underlaid this tremendous increase in numbers?
Division of labor?
I would say the division of labor and the tremendous rise in the productivity of labor that it's made possible. Vastly more people are able to survive on a vastly higher level thanks to the tremendous increase in what the average unit of labor can produce. And it's had tremendous benefits for the size of population in the third world countries also. Because just think, if there is the danger of famine in a third world country, what again and again bails them out? Food supplies from the first world. What is it that prevents outbreaks? You know, prior to the 18th century, there were recurrent not only famines but also plagues, and the tremendous devastation of a plague was the result largely of things like widespread malnutrition, generally poor sanitation, poor water supplies. Well, how does the division of labor and the tremendous improvements in productivity that it makes possible, how does that relate to the elimination of dread factors like famines and plagues worldwide? Well, it's obviously been responsible for radically reducing these things. There hasn't been a famine in any Western country since the Irish potato famine in 1848. And that was an aberration. There had been no famine in any Western country for several generations prior to that. And the biggest plague that we've had in the Western world, I'd hesitate to even call it a plague, I think the worst outbreak of death from any kind of illness was the influenza epidemic following World War I. But in the Dark Ages, or even a little bit past that, the Black Death in Europe wiped out a third of the population in the space of 3 years, and such things were repeated. Well, you know, people complain about the size of the population, but I think all of us who are alive, or almost all of us, are very glad to be that way. And what makes it possible for most of us to be alive and to have the tremendous prosperity that we do is the fact that we live in a division of labor society. Now, economics, as the science that studies the division of labor, is in a position to explain what sorts of things will promote it, what sorts of things will destroy it. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that what depends on an understanding of economics in the last analysis can be the literal survival of material civilization. Now, why? Well, as I've said, the division of labor doesn't exist or function automatically. It depends on human choices. People make decisions that affect the division of labor, not as isolated individuals particularly, but in their political capacity. If you have a country with a government that is enacting policies, a government is in a position to do something that may be conducive to the division of labor or harmful to it. And if you have governments acting on wrong ideas, they're capable of committing serious devastation. And if the citizens have beliefs, and those beliefs are destructive, and they lead the government to adopt destructive policies, well, that is the threat to the division of labor. And the analogy I use, people who are today alive in a modern division of labor society, enjoying all of its benefits, in effect, they're wandering among the equipment of a modern factory. But if they don't understand its maintenance or safety requirements, and they're randomly pushing buttons and pulling levers, which is, in effect, what is done when people vote for politicians who will impose this or that policy without knowing what they're doing, then you have the potential for major destruction. The only way that a modern society can be preserved in the last analysis is on the foundation of a serious, widespread knowledge of economics. Okay, well, I see on my watch we've gotten to about 20 to 8, and I said we'd take our break at that time. So why don't we do that, and you think of any questions you may have, comments, objections, whatever, and then we'll pick up at 5 after 8, 25 minutes from now. So see you then.